Halloween kills, more like Halloween bombs in stand-up comedian vernacular. But this isn't a comedy, nor is it a horror, it's more of a tragedy. Another disappointment in the series, despite a few choice moments, like when Michael Myers is selecting which knife to use in the kitchen of one of his victims, and he's stabbing repeatedly in thin air, just pretty impactful, or the solid, stellar soundtrack and above-board performances. Still, let's hear why Halloween Kills stinks. Join us.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
Right? The boogeyman was real.
It's over.
We can't hurt anyone ever again.
No one told you.
Told me what?
Somebody in there?
Michael Myers is alive.
Stop! You had a knife in your stomach.
You and Allison should not have to keep running. Evil dies tonight.
I'm not just gonna sit and watch another innocent person die.
If you track Michael's victims, that's a straight line to Michael's childhood home.
What do we do?
We fight.
Let's hunt him down.
Michael Myers is flesh and blood. But a man couldn't have survived that fire. The more he kills, the more he transcends.
Run! Go home now!
He's the essence of evil.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's a special edition of the Really Awful Movies podcast, Halloween 2018 and Halloween Kills. And forgive me right off the bat here, it's a suitably blustery fall day, so you might hear a bunch of crash and bangs as I'm recording this in close proximity to my balcony, and apologies if I can't in post fix all the various recording shortcomings. And speaking of shortcomings, well, here we go, right? Halloween 2018 and Halloween Kills represent a tale of two films. I almost want to quote The Simpsons here. It was the best of times, it was the bluest of times, you stupid monkey. But it's the two David Gordon Green properties that actually do represent a tale of two films. I think if you were to combine the strengths of both and excise the weaknesses, you'd actually have one memorable Halloween reboot film. But I think what happened in the case of this is that market forces and the pressure of releasing a quick succession of movies for maximum box office punch is showing ill effects for this franchise, much in the same way the declining Star Wars franchise efforts have been of late. I think it's very similar. As it stands, though, each film is deeply flawed, and in one key aspect, missing one element the other lacks, and vice versa. Halloween 2018, in our eyes, speaking for Jeff, I think it's an unadulterated, unmitigated failure on all counts, particularly disappointing given all the hype and the anticipation and the build-up and the fact that the trailer was actually really well done and really impactful. When it comes to the actual film, I saw it the first night it opened in front of a bored audience in Toronto, and while you can't deconstruct a film's success and failings from reactions, especially in comedy when people laugh at really dumb shit, I think for horror it's particularly pertinent. The audience I saw 2018 with shared my misgivings, not to mention my facial expressions, stone-faced. 2018 was joyless, perfunctorily methodical, and a complete dud overall. And the biggest failing in Halloween 2018 was a total lack of atmosphere, especially given what John Carpenter was known for creating his inestimable 1978 effort. And it's particularly surprising given that. I mean, there are other failings as well, including an insane and inane plot twist involving Loomis's protege, dismissively referred to as the new Loomis by many, including yours truly. For the original Halloween, you could argue it was all atmosphere, coming at almost the expense of everything else, as the characters, save for Laurie Strode, were so underdeveloped, and so was the plotting. And that's not really a criticism, as John Carpenter's film is a singular achievement and should be in any horror fan's top 20, if not top 10 films of all time. It certainly is in mine, and that wasn't a debit there, that it had those drawbacks. After all, its runtime is taut, lean, and it's suspenseful beginning to end with no fat. While 2018's Halloween lacked an atmosphere, Halloween Kills has atmosphere to spare. It's almost like someone offered up the movie equivalent of network notes or did some focus group testing to figure out what would improve matters between 2018 and 2021. But the question remains, like, is a heightened atmosphere and darkness in Halloween Kills enough to save the day? I'm talking atmosphere in relative terms here rather than in absolutes, unfortunately. Yes, it's more gritty. Yes, it's more dark. Yes, it's more foreboding than its predecessor, but that's not really saying much, really. I'll admit it does work in the film's favor, especially with some of the gory kills that are kind of impactful. What Halloween 2018 has that Kills lacks is a better story, I think, albeit one that was horribly, very badly mishandled. I actually think that by combining the narratives in both Halloween 2018 and Halloween Kills, now that would have made for an interesting movie, because at least there would have been enough moving parts to continue to generate a sustained interest. In 2018's Halloween, you have podcasters pursuing the story of Laurie Strode, and Jeff and I are podcasters, obviously. And I think it's an interesting idea to tap into the zeitgeist of the true crime occurrent obsession that's happening these days. And I think the characters, however, were so irredeemably dumb that it seemed like rather than being a key part of the story as investigators trying to assist in the Myers murders or being subject matter experts, I think they were merely there to provide Michael Myers with a mask, and I think to some extent to add to the body count and just really to deliver a bunch of useless exposition. And the most galling part of the whole podcaster conceit, I think, was them actually paying Laurie Strode to appear as a guest first off, then recording a show in a graveyard instead of a studio with nice pristine sound, and not in any way referencing it whatsoever that they were in a graveyard. It was pointless and stupid, and no podcaster would have the money to pay someone off like that. It's not like it's an epic score of a sit-down interview like Marc Maron and Barack Obama. It's just two morons carrying around a Zoom mic, and that was downright embarrassing, as was them shaking a mask in front of Michael Myers at the mental hospital. They would never have been let into the premises with it, but still, it's the idea that counts. The new Loomis, as they call him, meanwhile, was a self-aggrandizing publicity hound, and that's actually something Rob Zombie explored, and it's kind of an idea that I like as well, in order to keep some continuity with the original Loomis character and Donald Pleasance. And I really liked the idea of a PTSD Laurie Strode family disintegration and her really feeling the after effects even so many decades later and being holed up in a compound and losing her mind. After all, it's a great way to showcase the series' arguably most compelling character and iconic Jamie Lee Curtis. By contrast, Halloween Kills has an unlikely gathering of survivors from the first movie all hanging out in a crappy bar on a Halloween talent night. Why? Who the hell knows? It's almost a bit like 9/11 survivors having rooftop drinks on September 11th. It's weird, it's dumb, and what is, does this bar hold a support group for meetings, like meetings for crime victims? It really makes no sense. It's merely a way to introduce us to perhaps the film's strength, although it's a glue that doesn't wholly bind the production together, and that's one Tommy Doyle, the kid that Laurie Strode was babysitting in 1978, who becomes a focal point here, and that's Anthony Michael Hall portraying Tommy Doyle, looking way more sinister and intimidating than Brian from The Breakfast Club could ever have imagined being. His character exists, however, I think solely to mobilize townsfolk. Like, he puts the mob in mobilize. It's basically a group of vigilantes to track down Michael. It's basically nothing but a rehash of Halloween 4, and that's something that's actually really dumb. Horror movie 101 here, bit of a tangent lecture. This comes from Campfire Tales. It's better to have small groups of people speak in hushed tones about an evil legend or maybe a horrific event that transpired years ago. The more people, as it were, who are in on it, turns this into a very different film altogether and not the quietly contained John Carpenter movie, but more a bigger, larger Romero zombie film of disparate people banding together to confront evil, absent law enforcement. It's not something that ever worked in Halloween's favor, and it's not something that works here. Halloween succeeds in quiet, in the shadows, not large groups of people stupidly chanting "Evil dies tonight," a hopelessly dumb device repeated ad nauseum as the torches and pitchfork denizens of Haddonfield mistake a Smith's Grove Psychiatric Hospital mental patient for the real Michael Myers. And they chase him around, and he eventually jumps to his death to avoid them. It's a case of mistaken identity. And it's a terrific clarion call about the dangers of vigilantism. That's pretty neat, but it's handled in such a ham-fisted and ad hoc way. It was rendered totally and utterly idiotically. Like, once the guy died, the mob mobilized around him and said, okay, what do we do now? With nary a concern for the guy's well-being or the fact that they may have got in over their heads with this kind of mentality. The mob actually dominates the film, running around with baseball bats, chasing mental defectives through the hospital, acting paranoid, and generally accomplishing nothing of any value on the fright side of things. And Jamie Lee Curtis, compared with the prior effort, is given nothing to do. Like, all she does really is convalesce, which she's great at. She's a terrific actress. But then toward the coda of the film, she offers this moronic voiceover variant of FDR's kind of like the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, sort of a hoary spiel at the end. Like, you don't have fear to fear. Their fear is actually warranted in Haddonfield. It's a bit akin to the border wall issue. Like, fear built on national sovereignty or criminal trafficking or lawlessness at the border is actually warranted, but fear of migrants taking people's jobs is not warranted. Haddonfieldians, or whatever you call residents of Haddonfield, should be fearful. So Laurie warning about fear tearing people apart is kind of dumb and after the fact, when they should have known better right off the bat. Considering not one authority figure has proven themselves capable of dealing with the town's number one threat across a spate of movies, they should have come together and, you know, formed a citizens coalition to deal with this. They couldn't have done this countless times, but again, this film is retconning all the films that came before. But it's not the dumbest thing by far. It's one of the dumber things, that spiel coda. That one is reserved for Michael Myers emerging from the ostensibly deadly blaze from the 2018 film in which he was engulfed in fire. And The serial killer lays waste to a bunch of first responders and firefighters, making them meet their makers with a pickaxe, almost like the miner from the My Bloody Valentine 1980s Canadian horror film. It's really effing dumb, as the element of surprise, quietude, surreal stealth, and just overall weirdness and surrealness is how Michael Myers earned his bones. It's not taking on all comers like he's a protagonist in Old Boy or some sort of action movie hero. That was such a poorly executed part of this flick, among many, and damn near impossible for Halloween Kills to, I think, recover from. Halloween Kills, however, ultimately represents a strict contravention of the show-don't-tell rule. Like, there's lots of quick flashes to the events of 1978 that's rendered in sepia and grainier, which is a bit like, I don't know, a Jaws reboot reminding citizens of Amityville that they didn't close the beaches in time to thwart disaster back in the day. It's a pointless exercise. And I think the filmmaker should have focused on, you know, put this in all caps, like, make a new movie already. Like, don't rely on people knowing or not knowing who did what or who didn't do what or who was where in 1978 compared with 2018. Halloween Kills is hamstrung by fan service to the original, but also its predecessor and trying to introduce the franchise to new fans. Like, that almost never works, nor does a bottomless well of exposition in order to pull this off. There are so many references to the first film, it's almost like some, like, 1978 Halloween is like some obscure John Cassavetes indie film that a mainstream, and not a mainstream box office hit, everyone and their brother has seen and knows about. And to close here, I think this really underscores how the slasher genre has evolved past Halloween. While Season of the Witch is getting a deserved reappraisal of late, and Halloween 2 was a pretty solid sequel back in, what, 1981, the series as a whole is simply not that good. You know, it may ruffle a few feathers here, but by comparison, A Nightmare on Elm Street surpasses it vastly in terms of quality storytelling, ingenuity, practical effects, plotting. Even the misbegotten second installment looks good upon revisiting. It's a bit cheesy, but in the grand scheme of things, it's actually not half bad. And now I don't want to say anything about the Jackie Earle Haley thing. That less said about that, actually, the better. But overall, A Nightmare on Elm Street is something that can continue to be added to, as the Freddy character is so much more engaging and interesting than Michael Myers. And on the slasher front, you can take a film like Terrifier, for example, which looks to the past in terms of execution, but is thoroughly set in the present. It's brutal, and it represents, I think, a solid reinvention of the slasher film, a movie that actually does a lot with very little. It's a brutal one, and I think about it to this day. Halloween, by contrast, Halloween Kills does very little with a lot. I can't help but imagine what Ari Aster, Brandon Cronenberg, or the litany of modern, you know, the current crop of indie horror filmmakers would have done, who people with a more profound understanding of the genre than David Gordon Green, what that group would have done with a $20 million budget. Like, with that in the hands of someone really talented, they could have really rebooted this and brought it to a new generation with something that gave it legs and gave it runway, instead of just culminating in what's likely to be a pretty terrible Halloween ends by the looks of things. We can only speculate. Listen, we all know that horror is ultimately subjective and that different things frighten different people. Fair. The true litmus test of horror is watching a movie alone in your basement in the darkest of dark nights, and I think it's fair to say Halloween Kills doesn't even really offer much in terms of scares. At this point in the podcast, this should probably segue into what I've learned. There's a brutal, atypical kill by Michael Myers involving a double-thumbed eye gouging. It's rendered brutally and fine, I suppose, but not in the really visceral, choking and impactful way Lucio Fulci might have made audiences squirm with a protracted scene like that 40 years ago. It just doesn't compare. It just comes off as a kind of a shrug moment. Another thing I learned is Nancy Stevens reprises her role as Marion Chambers, the retired former assistant to Dr. Loomis. And this character was in the original, the retcon films, Halloween 2, Halloween H2O 20 years later. And it's not like anyone would have been clamoring for her to appear again. And speaking of Halloween H2O, while I was watching this one, I texted Jeff and said, you know, I said, hey, hot take here. Actually think as bad as and as corny as Halloween H2O is, H2O is actually better than the two recent Halloween movies. I don't know if I would actually really want to die on that hill debating it particularly, but let's put it this way. I've seen Halloween H2O twice, and I won't revisit either David Gordon Green film. I take Joseph Gordon-Levitt over David Gordon Green. Come to think of it, the more time passes, I'd actually take Rob Zombie's film, as bad as that one was, over any of the current crop. I think Zombie is responsible for the single most disturbing moment of any of the recent incarnations of Michael Myers films, and that was when the young, bullied, stringy-haired young Myers tails his assailant into the woods and beats him with a tree branch in a dizzying, camera-swiveling scene. Now, that film obviously explored Michael Myers as a coming of age, how he came to be. And say what you will about Zombie, but unlike David Gordon Green, he really knows his horror and brings the goods in that film in at least three occasions. Another thing I've learned is one of the victims of Michael Myers is Boston comedy legend Lenny Clark. He gets it in his home, and as does his elderly wife. He's a Dennis Leary co-star in the fireman drama Rescue Me, which almost in the context of this fire-addled and firefighter-replete scene is almost a Tarantino-esque in-joke. Another thing I learned is, speaking of pyromania, is that the opening sequence is actually really cool. As someone who carved a bunch of pumpkins this year, I really dig both the original Carpenter title sequence, one of the best ever in horror, but I gotta give credit to the filmmakers here with the pumpkins burning. That's worth half a star right there. However, I think ultimately things burn out pretty quick. I'm going to give this one 2 3/4 stars. Halloween Kills is highly, highly unnecessary, very skippable, and adds very little in terms of value to the series as a whole or in separated out on its own. It doesn't do much for me. I'm increasingly less enthused about the way this thing is going to conclude, and we all know it's going to reboot anyway with someone else at the helm to reach out to a new generation 10, perhaps 20 years hence. So really, what's the difference, right? And for all we know, the David Gordon Green stuff is going to be retconned, and the whole shebang is going to go up in smoke, to burn a metaphor and beat one to death. Anyway, continue to listen to the Really Awful Movies podcast, new episodes of which are uploaded for your listening enjoyment every Friday, and we shall talk to you soon. Take care.